Simon & Schuster Audio presents Barkskins, a novel by Annie Proulx. Read by Robert Petkoff. A PDF with the Sell and Duke family trees is included with this program.
Why shouldn't things be largely absurd, futile, and transitory? They are so, and we are so, and they and we go very well together. George Santayana. In antiquity, every tree, every spring, every stream, every hill had its own genius loci, its guardian spirit. These spirits were accessible to men, but were very unlike men. Centaurs, fauns, and mermaids show their ambivalence. Before one cut a tree, mined a mountain, or dammed a brook, it was important to placate the spirit in charge of that particular situation and to keep it placated. By destroying pagan animism, Christianity made it possible to exploit nature in a mood of indifference to the feelings of natural objects. Lynn White, Jr. Part 1. Forêt, H. Famille. 1693-1716. 1. Trépanier. In twilight they passed bloody Tadoussac, Quebec, and Trois-Rivières, and near dawn moored at a remote riverbank settlement. René Selle, stiff black hair, slanted eyes, yeux bridés, in ancient times invading Huns had been at his people, heard someone say, Wobik. Mosquitoes covered their hands and necks like fur. A man with yellow eyebrows pointed them at a rain-dark house. Mud, rain, biting insects, and the odor of willows made the first impression of New France. The second impression was of dark, vast forest, inimical wilderness. The newcomers, standing in the rain, waiting to be called to make their marks in a great ledger, saw the farmers clumped under a sheltering spruce. The farmers stared at them and exchanged comments. At his turn, René made not only an X, but the letter R, marred by a spatter of ink from the quill, a letter which he had learned in childhood from the old priest who said it was the beginning of René, his name. But the priest had died of winter starvation before he could teach him the succeeding letters. Yellow eyebrows regarded the R.
"Quite the learned fellow, eh?" he said.
He bawled out,
"Monsieur Claude Trépanier!"
And René's new master, a shambling, muscular man, beckoned him forward. He carried a heavy stick like a cudgel. Drops of rain caught in the wool of his knitted cap. Thick brows couldn't shadow his glaring eyes, the whites so white and flashing they falsely indicated a vivacious nature.
"We must wait a little," he said to René.
The damp sky sagged downward. They waited. Yellow Eyebrows, the deputy whom his new master called Monsieur Bouchard, again bawled,
"Monsieur Trépanier!"
who this time fetched a familiar. Charles Duquet, a scrawny engagé from the ship, a weakling from the Paris slums who during the voyage often folded up in a corner like a broken stick. So, thought René, Monsieur Trépanier had taken two servants. Perhaps he was wealthy, although his sodden drogué cloak was tattered. Monsieur Trépanier trampled up the muddy path toward a line of black mist. He did not so much walk as hurl himself along on his varied legs, one limber, one stiff. He said,
"Allons-y!"
They plunged into the gloomy country, a dense hardwood forest broken by stands of pine. René did not dare ask what services he would be performing. After years of manly labor chopping trees in the Morvan Highlands, he did not want to be a house servant. In a few hours, the sodden leaf mold gave way to pine duff. The air was intensely aromatic. Fallen needles muted their passage, the interlaced branches absorbed their panting breaths. Here grew hugest trees of a size not seen in the old country for hundreds of years, evergreens taller than cathedrals, cloud-piercing spruce and hemlock. The monstrous, deciduous trees stood distant from each other, but overhead their leaf-choked branches merged into a false sky, dark and savage. Achille, his older brother, would have gaped at New France's trees. Late in the day, they passed by a slope filled with shining white trunks. These, said Monsieur Trépanier, were bouleaux blancs, and the sauvage made houses and boats from the bark. René did not believe this. The big trees made him think again of Achille, a flotteur, who had spent his brief years plunging in and out of the cold Yonne, guiding logs down the river. He had been powerful, immune to the water's chill, had worked until a log with a broken limb, sharpened and polished to a spear by the friction of its travels, had pierced his bladder, carrying him along like a gobbet of meat on a spit. René now wore his brother's underwear and wool trousers and his short coat. He wore Achille's sabots, though a barefoot life had given him calloused feet tough as cow hooves, hardened against French cold. In this new world, he would learn the cold was of a different order. The engagés, dizzy with the narcotic effect of deep forest, stumbled on sprawling spruce roots. Bébites assailed them, minuscule no-see-ums like heated needles, black flies with a painless bite that dispersed slow toxins, swarms of mosquitoes in such millions that their shrill keening was the sound of the woods. At a bog, Monsieur Trépanier told them to smear mud over their exposed skin, especially behind the ears and on the crown of the head. The insects crept through the hair and stabbed the scalp. That, said Monsieur Trépanier, was why he wore a toque in this damnable country. René thought an iron helmet would be a better choice. Monsieur Trépanier said the sauvage made a protective salve from spruce needle oil and animal fat, but he had none. Mud would do. They walked on through the dim woods, climbing over mossy humps, passing under branches drooping like dark funeral swags. The engagé's legs, weakened by the long ocean voyage, cramped with fatigue.
How big is this forest? Asked Duquet in his whinging treble voice.
He was scarcely larger than a child.
It is the forest of the world. It is infinite. It twists around as a snake swallows its own tail and has no end and no beginning. No one has ever seen its farthest dimension.
Monsieur Trépanier stopped. With his stick, he smashed out dry spruce twigs at the base of a tree. From beneath his cloak, he took a fire bundle and made a small blaze. They crouched around it, stretching out their purple hands. He unfolded a cloth wrapping, revealing a piece of moose meat, cut pieces for each of them. Famished, René, who had only hoped for bread, bit and tore at the meat. The gray mosquitoes hummed at his ears. Duquet looked out from puffed slits and, unable to chew, he sucked the meat. Beneath Monsieur Trépanier's generosity, they sensed contempt. They walked on through a chaos of deadfalls, victims of some great windstorm, Monsieur Trépanier following no discernible path but frequently looking upward. René saw he was following cut marks on certain trees, marks 10 feet above the ground. Later he learned someone had blazed the trees in winter, striding high above the earth in snowshoes like a kind of weightless wizard. The forest had many edges, like a lace altarpiece. Its moody darkness eased in the clearings. Unknown plants and curious blossoms caught their eyes, funeral spruce and hemlock, the bright new growth puffs at the tips of the pine branches, silvery tossing willow, the mint green of new birch, a place where even the sunlight was green. As they approached one opening, they heard an irregular clacking sound like sticks, gray bones tied in a tree stirred by the wind. Monsieur Trépigny said that the sauvage often hung up the bones of a killed animal after thanking its spirit. He led them around beaver ponds, protected by almost impenetrable alder creeches, warning that the narrow pathways were moose runs. They passed through wet country, hollows brimmed with tea-colored rainwater. The quaking sphagnum, punctuated with pitcher plants, sucked at every step. The young men had never imagined country so wild and wet, so thickly wooded. When an alder branch tore Duquet's jacket, he swore in a low voice. Monsieur Trépigny heard him and said he must never curse a tree, especially the alder, which had medicinal powers. They drank at streams, crossed shallow riffles curved like damascened scimitar blades. "Oh, how much longer," muttered Duquet, one hand to the side of his face. They came again to open forest, where it was easy to stride under the trees. "Sauvage burned away the underbrush," said their new master in a disparaging tone. In late afternoon, Monsieur Trépigny cried, "Porc-épic!" and suddenly hurled his walking stick. It whirled once and struck the porcupine a blow on the nose. The animal pitched down like a falling star, trailed by blood drops. Monsieur Trépigny built a big fire, and when the flames subsided into purple rods, suspended the gutted animal over the coals. The burning quills stank, but when he took the carcass off the fire, beneath the blackened crust, the meat was good. From his bottomless pockets, Monsieur Trépigny drew a bag of salt and gave them each a pinch. The leftover meat he wrapped in a greasy cloth. The master built up the fire again, rolled into his cloak, lay down under a tree, closed his fiery eyes, and slept. Rene's legs cramped. The cold, the pines hissing in the wind, wheedling mosquitoes and owl cries kept him awake. He spoke softly to Charles Duquet, who did not answer, and then he was silent. In the night, something half-wakened him. Morning began with fire. Though it was late spring, it was colder than cold France. Light crawled into the gloom. Monsieur Trépigny, gnawing on leftover meat, kicked Duquet and bawled, "Levez-vous!" René was up before Monsieur Trépigny could kick him. He looked at the meat in Monsieur Trépigny's hand. The man tore off a piece and threw it to him, tore another and threw it to Duquet as one might throw scraps to a dog. Then, headed out with his tireless, lurching gait, following the cuts high on the trees. The new servants saw only darkness except to their rear, where the abandoned fire winked beguilingly. The day was cold but dry. Monsieur Trépigny racked along a dim trail, but by noon the rain returned. They were stuporous with fatigue when they reached snarling water, a black river yet transparent as dark chert. On the far side, they saw a clearing filled with stacks of cordwood and the omnipresent forest pressing in. Smoke rose from a hidden chimney. They could not see the house, only mountains of wood and outbuildings. Monsieur Trépigny shouted. A woman in a moose-skin tunic painted with curling designs came around the end of the nearest woodpile and called out, "Gwe!" then turned away. René Sell and Charles Duquet exchanged stares. An Indian woman. Une sauvage. They followed Monsieur Trépigny into the frigid river. René slipped on a round river rock and half fell, thinking of Achille, of the icy Yonne. Fish veered around them, shot past. So many fish, the river seemed made of hard muscle. On the muddy shore, they passed a fenced garden plot of weeds. Monsieur Trépigny began to sing, "Marie, Marie, Dame Jolie." The engagés kept silent. Duquet's mouth was pinched as if the air burned, his eyes swollen almost shut. Beyond the woodpiles, they saw Monsieur Trépigny's house, their first sight of the timber pièce-sur-pièce style, the steep-hipped roof, the shape of the bell-cast eaves familiar from France. But every part was wood, except for three small windows set with expensive French glass. Against the trees, they saw a wigwam, which they learned the next day was the Sauvage woman's bark house, where she retreated with her children at night. Monsieur Trépanier took them to his storehouse. The interior stank of rotting potatoes, marsh hay, and cow shit. One end was partitioned off, and behind it they heard the breathing of a beast. They saw a black fire pit, a forge. Monsieur Trépanier, enamored of his own voice, continued to sing, made a fire in the pit, and left them. Outside, his voice receded.
Ah, bonjour donc, Franc Cavalier!
The rain began again. René and Duquet sat in darkness except for the light of the dying fire. There were no windows in the building, and when Duquet opened the door to let in light, clouds of savage midges and mosquitoes rushed them. They sat in the dark. Duquet spoke. He said that he was suffering from mal aux dents, toothache, and would run away at his first chance and return to France. René was silent. After a time, the door opened. The Sauvage woman and two children came in, their arms full. The woman said, "Bien, bien," and gave each of them a beaver robe. She pointed to herself and said, "Mali," for like most Mi'kmaqs, she found it difficult to pronounce the letter R. René said his name, and she repeated it, "Lene." The larger child set down a wooden bowl of hot cornmeal. They disappeared. René and Duquet scooped the mush out of the bowl with their fingers. They wrapped themselves in the robes and slept. It was not light when Monsieur Trépanier wrenched open the door and shouted in a hard voice,
"Allons-y!"
Behind the partition came the sound of jets of milk hitting the bottom of a wooden bucket. He tossed them pieces of smoked sturgeon and took his steel-bladed axe from the wall, gave them each a short, hafted, dulled axe. René's had a great chip missing from the cutting edge. In the dripping dawn, Trépanier led them past a maize garden and into a small clearing. He swung his arm in an arc and, in an ironic voice, called the cramped space his big clearing,
"Le grand défrichement,"
then began to chop at a tree with skillful strokes. He commanded them to do the same. He said today they would cut logs to build their quarters, an enlargement of his domus, so that they might vacate his storehouse as quickly as possible. René swung the short-handled trade tool, felt the jolt of the tree's resistance, swung again, embarking on his life's work of clearing the forest of New France. Duquet nibbled at a tree with his hatchet, a yellow discharge leaking from his bitten eyes. They limbed the fallen trees, rolled and dragged them to the edge of the clearing. The branches went aside to be chopped later into cordwood. The axe was dull. In the time it took René to fell one smallish tree, the master brought down three larger and was at work on a fourth. There must be a way to sharpen an axe with a quarter of the cutting edge gone, he thought. He would refresh its sharpness. With doubts, he chose a river cobble and began to grind with circular motions. There was no visible progress, and he soon began chopping again. Monsieur Trépanier picked up the useless cobble and threw it into the forest, took the axe from René and flourished it.
"To sharpen," he said, "we use sandstone, grès."
He pantomimed the sharpening. René wanted to ask where Monsieur Trépanier kept his sharpening stones, but the man's glaring expression kept him quiet. Monsieur Trépanier twisted his lips at Duquet's whittle marks. He regarded Duquet's lopsided face.
"Open your mouth,"
he said, tapped the rotten tooth with the blade of his knife, and muttered that he would pull it at the end of the day. Duquet made a negative sound. At the height of the sun, the Sauvage woman brought a pot of steaming maize. René had rarely eaten food at midday. With a wood chip, Monsieur Trépanier scooped out a glob. In the center of the maize melted a creamy substance. René took some on his wood chip, was overcome by the richness.
"Ah,"
he said, and took more. Monsieur Trepanier said tersely that it was cacamos, moose bone marrow. Duquet barely ate even this, and leaned against a tree, breathing noisily. At twilight, they left the clearing. Monsieur Trepanier clattered through his smithy tools until he found a pair of ironmonger's pliers. Duquet sat open-mouthed on a stump, and Monsieur Trepanier seized the tooth with the tool and wrenched. He dropped the yellow fang on the ground. Duquet spat blood and pus, his lower lip split from the weight of the pliers.
"Allons-y,"
said Monsieur Trepanier, moving toward his house. René saw him pick up Duquet's tooth and put it in his pocket. The men entered the single room, and their masculine stench blended into the human funk of the North Woods. The pockmarked Marie noticed René's nostrils flare at the smell of the house and threw an aromatic juniper branch on the fire. In the hubbub of brats, they heard some names: Elfège, Théotiste, Jean-Baptiste. But they all looked the same, and so like their Mi'kmaq mother that René forgot them immediately. Marie spoke a patois of mixed Mi'kmaq and terse French, with a few Portuguese phrases in a curious rhythm. The children had French names. She brought them a pot of unsalted stewed goose, cooked with wild onions and herbs. The meat fell off the bone, though Duquet could manage only a little of the broth. A small dish of coarse salt stood in front of Trepanier, and he pinched it up with thumb and two fingers.
"Marie does not cook with sel. The Mi'kmaq say it spoils the food. So always carry your own sel, René sel. Unless you can put your thumb in the victuals and season them with your name. Ha ha ha!"
Then came a plate of hot corn cakes. Monsieur Trepanier poured an amber syrup on his cakes, and René did the same. The syrup was sweet and smoky, better than honey, and he could not believe it came from a tree, as the master said. Duquet, exhausted by his ordeal, bent his head. Marie went to her cupboard and stirred something. She brought it to Duquet. Monsieur Trepanier said perhaps it was a potion made from green alder catkins, the very alders Duquet had cursed, so then the medicine would not work for him. Marie said,
"Willow leaf, willow bark, good medicine, Mali make,"
and Duquet swallowed it and slept that night. Day after day the chopping continued, and their hands swelled, blistered, hardened. The rhythm of chopping seized them despite the dull axes. Monsieur Trepanier watched René work.
"You've held an axe before. You have a woodsman's skill."
René told him about the Morvan forest where he and Achille had cut trees, but already that life was unmoored and slipping sidewise out of memory.
"Ah,"
said Monsieur Trepanier. The next morning he took their wretched axes from them and went off, leaving them alone.
"So," said René to Duquet, "what is Monsieur Trepanier? Is he a rich man or not?"
Duquet produced a hard laugh.
"I thought that between you and Monsieur Trepanier, all the knowledge of the world was conquered. Do you not know that he is the seigneur, and we are the censitaire, what some call habitant? He is a seigneur, but he wants to be a nobleman in this new country. He apportions us land, and for 3 years we pay him with our labor and certain products such as radishes or turnips from the land he allows us to use."
"What land?"
"A fine question. Until now we have been working, but there has been no mention of land. Monsieur Trepanier is full of malignant cunning. The king could take the seigneurie away from him if he knew. Did you really not understand the paper you signed? It was clearly explained in France."
"I thought it concerned only a period of servitude. I did not understand about the land. Does that mean we are to be farmers? Landowners?"
"Ouais. Plowmen and settlers, not landowners, but land users, opening the forest, growing turnips. If people in France believed they could own land here outright, they would rush in by the thousands. I, for one, do not wish to be a peasant. I don't know why you came here, but I came to do something. The money is in the fur trade.
I'm no farmer. I'm a woodsman. But I would like to have my own land very much.
And I would like to know why he took my tooth. I saw him.
And I too saw this.
There is something evil there. This man has a dark vein in his heart.
Monsieur Trépanier returned a few hours later with iron axes for them, the familiar straight-hafted Latène René had known all his life. They were new, and the steel cutting edges were sharp. He had brought good whetstones as well. René felt the power in this axe, its greedy hunger to bite through all that stood in its way, sap spurting, firing out white chips like china shards. With a pointed stone, he marked the haft with his initial, R. As he cut, the wildness of the world receded. The vast, invisible web of filaments that connected human life to animals, trees to flesh, and bones to grass shivered as each tree fell, and one by one the web strands snapped. After weeks of chopping, limbing, and bark peeling, of dragging logs to Monsieur Trépanier's clearing with his two oxen, cutting, notching, and mortising the logs as the master directed, lifting them into place, chinking the gaps with river mud, the new building was nearly finished.
We should be building our own houses on our assigned lands, not constructing a shared lodging next to his menage,
Duquet said, his inflamed eyes winking. Still they cut trees, piling them in heaps to dry and setting older piles alight. The air was in constant smoke, the smell of New France. The stumpy ground was gouged by oxen's cloven hooves as though a ballroom of devils had clogged in the mud. The trees fell, their shadows replaced by scalding light, the mosses and ferns below them withered.
Why? Asked René. Do you not sell these fine trees to France for shipmasts?
Monsieur Trépanier laughed unpleasantly. He loathed René's foolish questions.
Because the idiots prefer Baltic timber. They have no idea what is here. They are inflexible. They neglect the riches of New France, except for furs.
He slapped his leg.
Even 100 years ago, the Champlain, who discovered New France, begged them to take advantage of the fine timber, the fish and rich furs, leather and 100 other valuable things. Did they listen to him? No. Very much no. They let these precious resources waste, except for furs. And there were others with good ideas, but the gentlemen in France were not interested. And some of those men with ideas went to the English, and the seeds they planted there will bear bloody fruit. The English sent thousands to their colonies, but France cannot be bothered.
A spring advanced, moist and buggy, each tree sending up a fresh fountain of oxygen. Duquet's face swelled with another abscess. Monsieur Trépanier extracted this new dental offense and said commandingly that now he would pull them all, and Duquet would waste no more time with toothaches. He lunged with the blacksmith's pliers, but Duquet dodged away, shook his head violently, spattering blood, and said something in a low voice. Monsieur Trépanier, putting this second tooth in his pocket, spun around and said in a silky gentleman's voice,
"I'll have your skull."
Duquet leaned a little forward, but did not speak. Some days later, Duquet, still carrying his axe, made an excuse to relieve his bowels and walked into the forest. While he was out of earshot, René asked Monsieur Trépanier if he was their seigneur.
And what if I am? Then, sir, are we, Duquet and I, to have some land to work? Duquet wishes to know. In time that will occur. But not until 3 years have passed, not until the domus is finished, not until my brothers are here, and certainly not until the ground is cleared for a new maize plot, which is our immediate task, so continue. The land comes at the end of your service.
And he drove his axe into a spruce. Duquet was gone for a long time. Hours passed. Monsieur Trépanier laughed. He said Duquet must be looking for his land. With vindictive relish, he described the terrors of being lost in the forest, of drowning in the icy river, being pulled down by wolves, trampled by moose, or snapped in half by creatures with steaming teeth. He named the furious Mi'kmaq spirits of the forest, Chipichkam, Hairy Kukwes, Frost Giant Jenu, and unseen creatures who felled trees with their jaws. René's hair bristled, and he thought Monsieur Trépanier had fallen too deeply into the world of the savages. The next day they heard a quavering voice in the distant trees. Monsieur Trépanier, who had been limbing, snapped upright, listened, and said it was not one of the Mi'kmaq spirits, but one that had followed the settlers from France, the loup-garou, known to haunt forests. René, who had heard stories of this devil in wolf shape all his life, but never seen one, thought it was Duquet beseeching them. When he made to call back, Monsieur Trépanier told him to shut his mouth unless he wanted to bring the loup-garou closer. They heard it wailing and calling something that sounded like,
Maman!
Monsieur Trépanier said that to call for its mother like a lost child was a well-known trick of the loup-garou, and that they would work no more that day, lest the sound of chopping lead the beast to them.
Vite!
Monsieur Trépanier shouted. They ran back to the house. 2. Clearings. With Duquet gone,
eaten by the loup-garou,
said Monsieur Trépanier with lip-smacking noises, the seigneur became talkative, but told differing versions of his history while he chopped, most of his words lost under the blows of the axe. He had a skilled eye that could see where small trees stood more or less in a row, and these he would notch. Then fell the great tree at the end, which obligingly took down all the small trees. He said his people came from the Pyrenees, but another time he placed them in the north, in Lille, nor did he neglect Paris as his source. He described his hatred of villages and their lying, spying, churchy inhabitants. He despised the Jesuits. Monsieur Trépanier said he, his brothers, and their uncle Jean came to New France to enter the fur trade, although he himself had better reasons.
Our people in earlier times were badly treated in France. The popish demon church called us heretics and tortured us. They believed they had conquered us. They were wrong. We have held to our beliefs, hand, head, heart and body in secret for centuries, and here in New France we will go strong again.
He extolled the new land, said it would surpass old France in richness and power.
A new world that will become greater than cold-hearted old France with its frozen ideas. Someday New France will extend all the way to Florida, all the way to the great river in the west. Frontenac saw this.
René thought of it and agreed. New France was a prize if England kept away. But he did not often think of such things. He saw himself as a dust mote in the wind of life, going where the drafts of that great force carried him.
What, asked Monsieur Trépanier, is the most important thing? After God, of course.
René wanted to say land. He wanted to say seeds. He wanted to say stolen teeth. He didn't say anything.
Blood, said Monsieur Trépanier. Your family. Your blood people.
They are all dead, said René.
But Monsieur Trépanier ignored him and continued his history. He and his brothers, he said, went first up the mysterious Saguenay River
to barter with the Hurons for furs, and later with the Ottawa, building up trust. But we avoided the Iroquois, who loved the English and who, from childhood, practiced testing themselves against horrible tortures. They enjoy inflicting pain on others. The voyageur's life is a good life for my brothers, who will still ply the rivers. for me, a very disagreeable way. Now, he said, the Iroquois are less terrible than in former times, but all Indians were mad for copper kettles, the bigger the better, so large they could not be easily moved, and the possession of a kettle changed their wandering ways. Once they had that copper or iron kettle, no longer did they roam the forests and rivers so vigorously. Villages grew up around the kettles. All very well, but someone had to carry those monstrous vessels to them. Someone had to toil and haul them up dangerous portage routes.
He pointed silently at his breast.
This was below my station in life.
And he smote his tree.
The fur trade moved north and west, he said to the tree
as he told of his disenchantment.
The portages, 6, 8 miles of rucks with 2 fur packs, the weight of a cow. Then back to the canoe, and more packs of one of the cursed kettles. Finally, the canoe. You would not believe the enormous loads some of those men carried. One is said to have carried 500 weight each trip from early morning until darkness.
Carrying one of the detested kettles, said Trépanier, his right knee gave way. The injury plagued him still.
However, the fur company, with the rights the king assigned them, made me a seigneur and charged me to gather habitants and populate New France. This is the beginning of a great new city in the wilderness.
René asked a question that had bothered him since the first trek through the woods.
Why do we cut the forest when there are so many fine clearings? Why wouldn't a man build his house in a clearing? One of those meadows that we passed when we walked here. Would it not be easier?
But Monsieur Trépanier was scandalized.
Easier? Yes, easier, but we are here to clear the forest, to subdue this evil wilderness.
He was silent for a minute, thinking, then started in again.
Moreover, here in New France there is a special way of apportioning property. Strips of land that run from a river to the forest give each settler fertile farm soil, high ground safe from floods, and forest trees for timber, fuel, and mushrooms. It is an equitable arrangement, not possible with clearings taken up willy-nilly, bon gré, mal gré.
René hoped this was the end of the lecture, but the man went on.
Men must change this land in order to live in it. In olden times, men lived like beasts. In those ancient days, men had claws and long teeth, nor could they speak, but only growled.
He made a sound to show how they growled. René, chopping trees, felt not the act, but the pure motion. The raised axe, the gathering tension in arms and shoulders, buttocks and thighs, the hips pivoting, knees loose and flexed, and then the swing downward as abstract as the shadow of a stone, a kind of forest dance. He had bound a rock to the pole with babiche to counterbalance the heavy bit. It increased the accuracy of each stroke. Monsieur Trépanier launched into a droning sermon on the necessity, the duty, of removing the trees, of opening land not just for oneself, but for posterity, for what this place would become.
Someday, Monsieur Trépanier said, pointing into the gloom, someday men will grow cabbages here. To be a man is to clear the forest. I don't see the trees, he said. I see the cabbages. I see the vineyards.
Monsieur Trépanier said his uncle Jean Trépanier, dit Chamailleur for his disputatious nature, Chama for short, would take Duquet's place. He was old but strong, stronger than Duquet. He would arrive soon. Monsieur Trépanier's brothers would also come. Eventually. And he said the time for felling trees was now over. The bébites were at their worst, the wet heat dangerous, the trees too full of sap. Indeed, the hellish swarms of biting insects were with them day and night.
Winter. Winter is the correct time to cut the forest. Today is the time for removing stumps and burning.
It was also the time, he added, for René to begin to fulfill his other duties.
For 3 days a week your labor is mine, is part of your work, said Monsieur Trépanier. You are to supply my table with fish.
The more immediate work involved preparing the gardens for Marie. The oxen, Roi and Rennes, pulled Monsieur Trépanier's old plough sullenly. A savage fly with a green head battened on their blood. Monsieur Trépanier smeared the animals with river clay, which hardened into dusty clots, but could do nothing about the clustering gnats. But Marie, the Indian woman, steeped tamarack bark in spring water and twice daily sluiced their burning eyes. In the long afternoons, with many sighs, she planted the despised garden. One day that summer she sent her two young sons to a place called Odenak, where remnants of her people had fled.
Goose, catch, learn them. Many traps learn. Good men's there hunting. Here, only garden, cut tree learn.
Monsieur Trépanier said acidly that what they would learn would be rebellion against the settlers and warfare. Mindful of his fishing duties, René went to the river. Monsieur Trépanier had given him a knife, fish hooks, a waxed linen line, and a large basket for the fish. In the river, fish were large and angry, and several times the linen line parted and he lost a precious hook. But Marie was scornful.
Small fish, she said. Good fisherman, not Lené. My people make weirs. Catch many, many. Big many.
To divert her irritation, he pointed at a stinging nettle in the garden.
We have those in France, he said.
Yes, bad plant grow where step white man people. Those, who is it coming? Wenuj.
Marie asked him to leave the fish intact. She would clean them herself. She buried the entrails in the garden, and when René asked her if that was the Indian way, she gave him a look and said it was a common practice for all fools who grew gardens instead of gathering the riches of the country.
Eels, she said. Eels catch. Eels liking us. We river people.
She wove 3 eel traps for him and gave him fish scraps for bait, went with him to the river and showed him likely places to try. Almost every day thereafter he brought her fat eels. She said the Mi'kmaq had many ways to catch eels and that the traps were best for him. When her sons came back from the Abenaki village of Odenak, they could show him other ways. In early July the pine trees loosed billows of pollen, yellow plumes like citrine smoke drifting through the forest, mixing with the smoke from burning trees. One morning an old man, his back bent beneath a bundle, his glaring eyes roving left and right, came ricketing out of the pollen clouds from the west trail, which led, as far as René knew, to the end of the world. Above the little mouth stretched a gray mustache like a bit of sheep's wool caught on a twig. The eyes were like Monsieur Trépanier's eyes, black and white and rolling. Chamailleur looked at René, who was preparing to go fishing, and started in at once.
Salut, you bastard! Why are you not working? I am. It is part of my duty to supply the house with fish for the table. What? With a string and a hook? You must use a net. Have the woman make a net, or a basket trap, or you must use a spear. Those are the best ways. For me, the line and hook are best. Stupid and obstinate. Oui, stupid et obstiné. I know what is best, and you do not. It is good I came. I can see you need correction. My nephew is too easy.
René continued stubbornly with his hooks and twisted linen line. But he thought about nets. A net might be better, for the fish were so thick in the river, he might get several large ones at the same time. As for Marie's insufferable speechifying on the ways the Mi'kmaq built different kinds of weirs how they hunted esturgeon at night with blazing torches and spears, he ignored all she said. He did use the eel traps she had made, excusing himself on the ground that eels were not fish. Searching for land to claim when his servitude ended, he discovered Monsieur Trépanier's secret. He had walked far upstream. Recent rains had enlarged the river to a bounding roar over its thousands of rocks. He thought it might be best to choose land not too close to the river, but something with a spring or modest stream. He made his way through an old deadfall where in between the fallen trees millions of saplings grew, as close together as broom straws. Twice he heard a great crashing and saw a swipe of black fur disappear into the underbrush. In early afternoon he came onto a wide but faint trail trending east-west and wondered if it might connect to Monsieur Trépanier's clearing to the east. Instead, with the afternoon before him, he turned west. He saw traces of old ruts that could only have been made by a cart. It was not an Indian trail. Now he was curious. In mid-afternoon, the trail divided. He followed the wagon ruts. The way became markedly different in character than the usual forest path. Trees had been carefully cleared to create the effect of an allée, the ground thinly spread with thousands of broken white shells. He saw this allée ran straight, a dark tunnel of trees with a pointed cone of light at the end. He had seen these passageways in France leading to the grand houses of nobles, although he had never ventured into one. And here, in the forests of New France, was the blackest, harshest allée of the world, the trees like cruel iron brushes, white shells cracked by deer hooves. The end of the allée seemed filled with light, a void at the limit of the tilting earth. A massive pale thing loomed up, a whitewashed stone house, almost a chateau that might have been carried on the sea winds from France and dropped in place. René knew that this was Monsieur Trépanier's domus, the center of his secret world. There were three huge chimneys. The windows were of glass, the roof of fine blue slate, and a slate walkway curved around the building, leading to a fenced enclosure. The fence was tall, formed of ornate metal rods. Everything except the stone had come from France. He knew it. It must have cost a fortune, two fortunes, a king's ransom. It was the proof of the seigneur's madness, his mind clotted with old heretic ideas of clan and domus, himself the king of an imaginary world. Disturbed, René cut back to the main trail and followed it east. Dusk was already seeping in. Night came quickly in the forest, even in the long days. As he had guessed, the trail ended in Monsieur Trépanier's clearing. He went straight to the cabin he now shared with Shama, who was rolled up in Duquet's old beaver robe, snoring and mumbling. The summer months went on. Shama, bossy and cursing, decided where they would cut. They cleared trees, dragging stumps into line to form a bristled root fence. René fished for the table, listened to Marie tell Mi'kmaq stories to Elfège, Théotiste, and Jean-Baptiste about beaver bone soup and rainbow clothes and the tiny Wigulademouche, and as he absorbed that lore, he watched Monsieur Trépanier and wondered about his secret house, which later he learned the seigneur had named Le Triomphe. He had the coveted particule and could call himself Claude Trépanier du Triomphe. The heat of summer disappeared abruptly. Overnight, a wedge of cold air brought a new scent, the smell of ice, of animal hair, of burning forest, and the blood of the hunted. 3. Renaudette. Violent maples flared against the black spruce. Rivers of birds on their great autumnal journeys filled the skies. Hudsonian godwits, whole nations of hawks, countless black warblers, paruline rayée, looking like tiny men with their black berets, chalky faces, and dark mustache streaks, cranes, long spurs, golden eyes, loons, sparrows, flycatchers, warblers, geese. The first ice storm came one night in October. Then the world pressed flat, snow hissing in the spruce needles, the sun dimmed by a grisaille wash, the forest clenched into itself as though inhaling a breath. Marie's sons, Elfège and Théotiste, returned from Odenac carrying traps and snares, whistles and calls to lure game. Marie was intensely interested in these objects, but Monsieur Trépanier called them rubbish and threw Théotiste's beaver funnel trap into the fireplace. René watched the boy's face harden, watched how he kept his eyes lowered, not looking at Monsieur Trépanier. For a moment he saw in Théotiste the cruel Indian. December brought stone-silent days, though a fresh odor came from the heavy sky, the smell of cold purity that was the essence of the boreal forest. So ended René's first year in the new world. Snow, heaped in great drifts, smothered the trees so thickly they released avalanches when the wind rose. René learned he had never before in his life experienced extreme cold, nor seen the true color of blackness. A burst of ferocious cold screwed down from the circumpolar ice. He woke in darkness to the sound of exploding trees, opened the door against a wall of palpable chill, and his first breath bent him in a spasm of coughing. Jerking with cold, he managed to light his candle, and as he knelt to remake the fire, he saw minute snow crystals falling from his exhaled breath. At breakfast, Monsieur Trépanier said it was too cold to cut trees.
On such a day, frozen axe blades shatter, and one burns the lungs. Soon you cough blood. Then you die. It will be warmer in a few days.
When René mentioned hearing trees explode, the seigneur said that in such intense cold, even rocks could not bear it and burst asunder. Folding gelid moose bone marrow into a piece of bread, he said,
"One winter, after such a cold attack, I came upon 4 deer frozen upright in the forest."
"Ah, ah," said Chamas.
"One time in the north, when the weather was warm and pleasant for 10 days, then, in a single breath, a wind of immeasurable cold descended like an axe, and the tossing waves in the river instantly froze into cones of ice. We prayed we would not do likewise."
It was during this cold period that Marie's youngest child, Jean-Baptiste, who from infancy had suffered a constant little cough, became seriously ill. The cough deepened into a basso roar. The child lay exhausted and panting. The moon was a slice of white radish, the shadows of incomparable blackness. The shapes of trees fell sharply on the snow, of blackness so profound they seemed gashes into the underworld. The days were short, and the setting sun was snarled in rags of flying storm cloud. The snow turned lurid, hurling away like cast blood. The dark ocean of conifers swallowed the afterglow. René was frightened by the intensity of the cold, even in the weak sunlight, and by Jean-Baptiste's stertorous wheezes coming from his pallet near the fire, his weakening calls to Marie, and finally the everlasting silence. Monsieur Trépanier said coldly,
"All must pay the debt of nature."
The bitter Arctic plunge held for a week, then softened to a bright stillness. Marie carried the little body to the mission in Wobeek for safekeeping until spring burial. Men went into the forest again. They crossed the frozen river. René learned to walk on snowshoes into the chill world. Tree cutting was easier, and with endless wood supplies they kept a constant fire near the work. Elfège, who had grown taller at Odenac and could help with hauling branches, worked beside him.
"So," said René,
You have learned many hunting skills at that place.
Oui, many ways to catch every animal. All different each season. You see, over there.
He pointed west into the woods where they had not yet begun to cut.
That heap of snow.
Yes, said René.
What do you observe?
Ah, I observe a heap of snow.
If you go close to it, you will see more.
They walked together toward the mound. Elfège pointed to a small hole near the top. A feathery rime surrounded it.
You see, frozen breath of a bear.
He explained in great detail the ways the bear could be killed and extracted from its den. He continued to talk of ways to lure geese into a deep ditch so they could not open their wings and fly away, explained how to read the age of a moose track, to know the animal's sex, its size, and even its condition. René was astonished at the boy's knowledge. He was an Indian hunter, and he was, as Trépanier had prophesied, well-versed in trickery and deceit. René's free days exploring the forest gave him pleasure. Sometimes he went back to the Deadfall region near the West Trail, where the snow was mounded in fantastic heaps. He did not go near Monsieur Trépanier's elaborate house. A few days after Marie returned from the mission, Monsieur Bouchard, who, in addition to his duties as government deputy, was captain of the militia, came up from the river, moving easily on snowshoes.
What brings you here, Captain Bouchard? It's a long way, said Monsieur Trépanier. Is there a corvée or a militia mustering? Are the Iroquois advancing?
On the ship, a letter for you from France.
It looked pressing important. Red wax seals, a coat of arms. So I bring it to you.
They went up to the house.
The river is a shorter road by half than through the forest, said Monsieur Bouchard as they climbed the slope to the house. I wonder you don't use your canoe in the pleasant weather. Fighting the current is more arduous than walking.
Monsieur Trépanier examined the letter, his sallow skin suddenly scarlet, and put it unopened on the shelf near the door. The men sat at the table drinking hot water with a little whiskey in it.
We have a sad story in Wobik, said Monsieur Bouchard.
François Poignet, do you know him? By sight only. Tall and with a cast in one eye. A farmer.
The same, but a good man. He went into the forest on his land during the recent cold to continue clearing. His wife died in childbed the summer past, and their only living child is a girl of 10, Leonardette. The unfortunate father's axe glanced off the frozen tree as off a block of granite, and cut his left leg to the bone.
Zut!
Said Monsieur Trépanier. He struggled to get back to his house. The blood trail marked his effort. Perhaps he called out. If so, no one heard him. He exsanguinated and froze. He was lying on his bier of frozen blood, more frozen than the axe when we found him.
It is a hard country, said Monsieur Trépanier.
In addition to bringing you that letter, I came to ask if you would take the girl into your household. She is young but strong. You know girls are valuable in this womanless land.
He winked.
Ah, said Monsieur Trépanier. Now I see why you made such a long trip. Why does not someone in Wobik take this girl? Why not Père Perrault? Why me? What is wrong with the child?
Monsieur Bouchard lifted his eyes to the smoky ceiling and rolled his head a little.
It's true that she is not perfect in form.
There was a long silence.
In what way is she not perfect in form?
Well, in form she is perfect enough, but she has a birthmark, tache de vin, on her neck.
And what does the tache de vin signify? That it repels the citizens of Wobik and the holy priest?
It is, in fact,
Monsieur Bouchard was sweating with the heat of the fire and the discomfort of his errand.
It is a perfect little image of a demon, with horns. I thought that as your religious beliefs...
And his voice trailed off. He looked yearningly at the door.
My religious beliefs? You think I would welcome a girl with the mark of the evil one on her neck? It is said... It is said you have a respect, not for God, but for the devil. I do not. Sir, I abhor the demon. You are misinformed. I believe that your Roman Catholic God is the devil, the demiurge. You have only to read in the Old Testament to see his cruelty. To me, that is the demon. It is you who worship the devil.
His squinted eyes caught the light as splinters of ice.
Perhaps I was misinformed, but my duty is to see the girl in someone's care. The people in the village...
Calling on public opinion was the last card in his hand.
No, don't speak to me of people in villages. Yes, as that may be, but people in the village have seen certain things. For example, they say they have seen you in the flying canoe with the devil and his impious boatman, plying the clouds and laughing cruelly.
He got it out in a tumble.
What rubbish, said Monsieur Trepanier. Who was this sharp-eyed person, witch, I should say, who sees such false wonders?
He had moved closer to the deputy.
I am not at liberty to name persons,
came the smug response of one who protects the innocent.
Have a care, Monsieur Bouchard.
The old deputy put up his chin.
You have a care, Monsieur Claude Trepanier du Triomphe. I have little interest in flying canoes and devil pacts, nor in you. I only want to find a place for the girl.
He added slyly,
She is skilled in brewing excellent beer. She learned well from her mother.
Marie brought more hot water to the table and, eyes downcast, said quietly,
That girl take me. No like make beer me.
There you go, cried Monsieur Bouchard. I'll send her right up. She's just down by the river.
Two strides and he was out the door, his long cloak whisking after him.
Captain Bouchard, wait!
Bellowed Trepanier at the closing door. He whirled around and struck Marie to her knees, then slammed out with his axe in hand. The skinny, sad child slowly climbed the snowy hill from the river. She was thin with lank hair. Dark circles under her small brown eyes, and a half-cringing way of carrying herself as though ducking blows before they had been struck. Her fingers were slender and dexterous. Marie, moving slowly, patted her shoulder twice, put a wooden spoon in her hand, and set her to stirring mush. When Monsieur Trepanier came in, he pulled her to the doorway to examine the demonic birthmark. He saw a small red triangle the size of a thumbnail on the nape of her neck, and at its top, two tiny triangles the height of a mosquito.
Ah! Said Monsieur Trepanier. It's no demon. The stupid townfolk have seen only what they wanted to see. The fools. It's a fox. We shall call you Renardette.
Despite her cringing manner, the girl was a competent brewer. She began by scouring the brew house and the stone brewing jars. She asked for hop seeds and planted them among the stumps. She picked the ripe hops herself and made very good beer. No one drank more of it than Renardette herself. Though Renée still preferred vin rouge, it had to be imported and was too costly. But if ever the settlers' apple orchards began to bear, they could have cidre. That would be pleasure. 4. Guests from the North. During René's third winter, Monsieur Trepanier began to behave erratically. He went off for weeks at a time, and when he returned, he was rudely commanding, even to Chama. In early May, with snow still on the ground, Monsieur Trepigny said he would be gone for a year, or perhaps two, as he had pressing business in Quebec and France. He told René that Chama would be in charge of the daily work. He marked out an impossibly large area, more than 5 arpents, almost 5 English acres, for them to clear of trees. In France, thought René, the forests were controlled by laws and customs. Here, there were no forest laws beyond the desires of the seigneur. That Trepigny had the right to order the clearing confounded him, and he sensed injustice. Trepigny slapped his gloves on his thigh and mounted his horse. He gave a last order.
Marie, do not neglect the garden.
Marie said nothing, but her fingers twitched. René knew she disliked gardening, considered it French foolishness. In the garden, she felt snared. She neglected it at every chance, she and Renaudette going to gather medicine plants. She knew the healing virtues of many tree barks. She kept moldy substances in a box to bind onto infected wounds. Some fungi she worked into salves.
Of course,
Monsieur Trepigny had sneered, as though describing a vicious fault.
All the Indians are physicians and apothecaries. They alone know the secret virtues of many plants. Have you never heard how they cured the Champlain's crew, dying of scorbut, with a broth of hemlock needles? Wait, you will hear it 1,000 times.
But now he was gone, and Chama pranced around like a rooster. And, like that of a rooster, his wet eye fell on the only hens in sight. In the night, René heard him slide stealthily out of his beaver robe and ease out the door, his footsteps squeaking in the stiff snow. In minutes, rapid running and the slamming door brought him back. More than 2 years passed before Monsieur Trepigny returned on a fine sorrel stallion. He sprang off with a flourish like the signature of a state minister. He was decked in a pea-green doublet with paned sleeves, silk breeches in darker green, and trimmed with knotted ribbons. His massive belt sported 3 silver buckles, and his boots showed crimson heels. The glory was a low-crowned hat with 6 red-dyed ostrich plumes wreathed around the brim. He smelled of a cloying perfume that made Elfège sneeze out a gob of snot onto the scalloped cuff of the doublet. Monsieur Trepigny knocked him to the ground and kicked him. Marie threw herself over the boy. Monsieur Trepigny gave her a powerful kick in the ribs as well, remounted his sorrel, and rode west, no doubt to revel in his secret house, thought René. At supper the next night, Marie served up stewed eels and dried salmon made into a thick fish pudding. Monsieur Trepigny exploded. Eels were savages' food, he said, and he expected something better, as befitted a seigneur. They were witnessing Monsieur Trepigny's transformation into a gentleman, manifested by his new garments and his dislike for eels, which in the past he had always relished. He expressed his growing disdain for the Indians, calling them lazy and ignorant barbarians. He threw a coin on the table in front of Marie and told her that she must pack up and leave with her children the morrow. He was marrying a French lady in a fortnight. The coin would pay her passage east back to her people, where she might eat all the eels in the world. Marie sat quietly, saying nothing, and René supposed she was unfeeling and submissive. It was mid-morning when they left the house. Marie, with her few possessions in a willow basket pack, the children each carrying a bundle. Renaudette said to Marie in a low voice that she did not want to go to Wobeek, that the people there treated her badly. Marie glanced at Chama, busy sharpening knives, but listening attentively.
Here bad, stay you. Come you. Safe that mission.
The little group went down the steps to where Monsieur Trepigny stood in the yard watching, legs spraddled like a colossus. Suddenly he turned to René.
What are you gaping at? Go with them! And in Wobeek, arrange with Philippe Boss to bring out my trunks on his cart. They are by now surely at the deputy's house. Be back in